Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. For all the returning listeners and subscribers, thank you for coming back. For those new to the channel, welcome. Hope you enjoy the show. If you do like what we're doing, please make sure you hit the like and subscribe button on your way out. Just a quick reminder, this show is a pre-recorded show. Our guest today is in the United Kingdom, and the normal streaming time for the show, which is 6 p.m. Pacific time, would be a little too late or early in the morning for our guest. So we're doing this pre-record for you, a show I've been trying to put together for a long time. I want to thank who kind of set this all off for me, our good friend of show, Amina Sheikh, that helped, you know, get the ball rolling. Where I could contact our guest. So it was harder than you think. Pakistan and Iran. Chaos recently unfolded when the Pakistan parliament convened after its recent election. Supporters have ousted and imprisoned former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his PTI party members were protesting for the release of Khan. And the elections were a sham. Khan, during his time in office, took a vehemently neutral stance on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. didn't like this. An August article from The Intercept, it looks like the U.S. was involved in the ouster of Khan in favor of a more Western regime. From The Intercept article, the meeting between the Pakistani ambassador to the United States and two state department officials has been the subject of intense scrutiny, controversy, and speculation in Pakistan over the past year and a half, as supporters of Khan and his military and civilian opponents jockeyed for power. The political struggle escalated on August 5th when Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison on corruption charges and taken into custody for the second time since his ouster. Khan's defenders dismissed the charges as baseless. The sentence also blocks Khan, Pakistan's most popular politician, from contesting elections expected in Pakistan later this year. One month after the meeting with U.S. officials documented in the leaked Pakistani government document, a no-confidence vote was held in parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. Since that time, Khan and his supporters have been engaged in a struggle with the military and its civilian allies, whom Khan claims engineered his removal from power at the request of the United States. That is from an article in The Intercept. Wherever you are watching and listening to this show, there should be links in the description to that article. With Khan out of office, China and the IMF are now being more friendly to Pakistan's economic woes and the money the country owes them. What does this mean for the people of Pakistan? With a strict military-backed prime minister in office, will Pakistan's corruption problems continue? How strong is the Pakistani left, and what power do they have to attempt to right the ship? Today we are joined by Aziz Malik. A geography and planning professor at the University of Liverpool, Dr. Malik is a human geographer engaged in the interdisciplinary study of class, state, and urban space. His research interests include Marxist and post-colonial anti-colonial theory with a focus on labor and social and urban politics in Pakistan, specifically in the global south. Please welcome our guest, Ayaz. Did I get it right?
Hello, hi, Jason. Yes, that's correct. Aziz was my late grandfather's name, so I'm also very happy to be associated with his name.
Was I at least kind of close?
No, as I said, Aziz is a different name. Ayaz is a different name, but Aziz was my grandfather. So
yeah. Okay.
So that's fine.
Well, look, first of all, thank you for taking the time to talk with me tonight, this evening. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about Imran Khan? Was he a reform candidate? And also, why was he so neutral in regards to the Russian invasion?
Okay, so sorry, Jason, can I ask just for the music in the background?
Oh, I'm going to drop it out right now.
Drop it out a bit. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. So yeah, about Imran Khan. So thank you so much, first of all, for having me, because it's a complex situation and a complex issue with a complex social history. And you know, I would start. You know, sometimes you know, there's of course we were talking about Marx before I got on, and Marx has this quote from the Jewish Question, which I really like, which is, you know, that the formulation, and he says at one point, he says that the formulation of a question is its own solution. So sometimes, you know, sometimes the questions, when we are asking perhaps not the right questions, then we are also not getting the correct answers, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So with the Imran Khan situation as well, a lot of the people on the Western left, they kind of, you know, end up asking the wrong questions, right? So for example, with this issue of the US, it will become clearer as we talk on. But in terms of your question about the reform candidate, right? So Imran Khan has historically, he was the head of, you know, what I would call a kind of center-right populist movement, which was at its core, it was, you know, based in Pakistan's middle classes, newly emergent middle classes, which have emerged from the 90s, 2000s, 2010s onwards, due to various other processes like economic liberalization and urbanization in Pakistan. But of course, like all populist movements, it also had a popular base, right? And like all populist movements, it was a movement which kind of positioned itself as a reform movement, but in power, it was a continuity movement, if you see what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. This is often the fate, often what happens with populist movements, because if they don't come in with a coherent program and with a coherent coalition of social forces which can upend the existing elites, then they often end up pandering to those existing elites, if you see what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. So with the Imran Khan movement, this is almost exactly what happens. This is a candidate, this is a person who has, you know, wild support in particular sections of Pakistan, in large sections of Pakistan middle class through the 90s, 2000s, increasing in the 2000s, 2010s. He's a national hero because he's a Cricket World Cup winning captain. He's one of the legendary cricketers, one of the great cricketers of all time. But also his rise is also related to the wider kind of crisis of the Pakistani ruling bloc, in which the relationship to the US is a big part of the puzzle. And you can talk about that later. But because Pakistan's ruling bloc basically is dependent on funds and patronage from imperialism, it has been for the past 70 years. And for the past, at least for the past 50 years, and arguably for the past 70 years since independence. And that kind of dependency on the US and Western powers has been changing through the 2000s, 2010s. And that kind of imperial cement has fallen off for the Pakistan ruling bloc. There was a wider crisis in society, in politics, in which Imran Khan emerges as this kind of hero of the middle class. But then crucially, in his ascension to power in the mid-2010s, towards the late 2010s, he forms basically an alliance with the Pakistani military. And for those of you who don't know, Pakistani military is basically the most entrenched political and economic player in the country. It is the biggest economic interest. It has interests in all of the sectors of the Pakistan's economy. It is like a $20-30 billion economic conglomerate. It has been the seat of kind of imperial American patronage and American aid, and fought wars for America in the region. And Imran Khan, and you know, it also patronizes this kind of huge network of politicians, elite brokers, middlemen, and so on and so forth. And Imran Khan's movement basically forms an alliance with the military and these kind of political brokers around the military, big landed elites, big capitalist elites, and so on, in his first stint in power, right? But the issue is that the crisis, the wider crisis that I'm talking to you about, which is an economic crisis, a political crisis, an ideological crisis, but fundamentally an economic crisis, he is not able to solve that while in power, fundamentally because he's dependent on the military, which is the most problematic part of the coalition itself. And of course, because as a middle-class kind of populist figure, Imran Khan and his party also don't have a coherent program to get out of the morass that Pakistan are in. And fundamentally what happens is that Imran Khan falls out with the military 3 years into his rule. And that is then what then sets the ball rolling for his removal. Now, the case of the US here is, you know, debatable. I mean, that intercept what do you call it?
The article
intercept,
that I'm going
yeah,
to.
that intercept, that intercept cipher, that intercept document is correct, obviously. But if you read it, what's happening there is that Donald Liu, this person who has a record of threatening third world governments and third world people, he's done that before in Nepal as well. There is was an article on the BBC about this. Raman Imran Khan had this no confidence motion. But anyway, the role of the US here is, you know, is debatable. Of course, absolutely, the US was not happy with Imran Khan and the Ukraine situation. But the thing is, because Imran was so reliant on the military, and in Pakistan, foreign policy is always set by the military, right? So it wasn't as if that Imran Khan was doing some, you know, amazing Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez type reorientation of Pakistani foreign policy. It was the statement that he gave, and Pakistan would already have voted neutral on Ukraine. And I can tell you why. Because Pakistan, as I said, has been historically dependent on the US, and it has supported US in its regional wars, like in Afghanistan, more specifically in the 80s and 2000s. But then if you look at the, for example, Yemen war, which has been happening for the last 10 years, right? And with the Saudis going after Yemenis and, you know, bombing them with American and UK support, the Saudis actually asked Pakistan for help in the previous prime minister's stint, the Nawaz Sharif stint before Imran Khan. And Pakistan did not agree at that point, right? So my point is that Pakistan's relationship with America, with these kind of wider regional wars, has been complex. So what happens with that Donald Liu meeting is happening in the context where already there are moves afoot from the late 2022 onwards, from the late 2021 onwards for the removal of Imran Khan, because one, he has been dependent on the military. And by the end of 2021, he basically falls out with the military. He falls out with the military for a number of reasons. One of them is internal appointments of the military. So the military wanted to change its intelligence office, its intelligence chief. Imran Khan didn't want to change the intelligence chief because the intelligence chief was a close ally of Imran Khan. So he didn't want to change the intelligence chief, but the military put its step down. The other issue was that because of the wider kind of discontent that happened, was that preceded Khan and marked his time in power, as I said, right? Because as I said, Khan comes to power on the back of this wider crisis. And his stint in power is really unstable because, as I said, he's reliant on the military, he's reliant on these elite brokers and so on and so forth. And the biggest, one of the biggest issues is that his government is very weak in the Punjab province, which is the biggest province of Pakistan. That's the central province. Okay. And that's also the province from which the military does most of its recruitment. Right. So overwhelming majority of the military, its officers, its soldiers come from Punjab. And in Punjab, Khan's government was especially chaotic. It had almost, you know, it was a coalition government, which was about four or five, factions within the government itself. And that kind of wider discontent was also translating into the military, into political recalculations. And then, of course, the final straw is that Khan falls out with the army chief over this issue of internal appointments. And that is really then what sets afoot this motion of no confidence. And then, but that is already happening at the end of 2021, early 2022. And then the Ukraine thing happens in February, March. So that is the wider context in which all of this is happening. And I think it's kind of simplistic and often can be misleading to see all of this as something, you know, that somehow America switched something on in the State Department and something happened in Islamabad. That is unfortunately not how history and politics works. We have to look at what I call the intersection of economic structure and social history to understand what has been happening.
Well, our good friend, and we have a thing here called the TIR, Central Committee. So Central Committee member, Professor Jean Bajlan, calls it kind of a reverse American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
Everything that happens in the world is because of America, good or bad.
Yeah. So the thing that's actually a very good point. So there are two ways of looking at this, right? One is the liberal understanding that there is no imperialism, right? That everyone has full autonomy. America is this benign actor for human rights, for, you know, spreading democracy in the world and so on. And that's of course nonsense, right? We know this. We've known this forever, people who are serious leftists. And the other one is, you know, again, pointing at real problems but giving incorrect answers. But this crude understanding that, you know, the societies in third world are kind of these blank slates, tabula rasas, in which, you know, America just switches something on, it completely totally happens automatically. But the thing is, societies and politics and economies are complex, and we have to look at all of these multiple forces which are going into the making of a moment, and then see, okay, how does imperialism structure these moments, and how does it not structure these moments, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, because, you know, in talking to you, you know, briefly before we even started recording, and from the little bit that I understand about this situation, Imran Khan didn't seem like he was, what would you call him? You say he's not Che Guevara or, you know, or Hugo Chavez. So there's no big reforms coming in. You actually said he was a center right figure for years in the country.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, one is this corruption platform. We were talking about this corruption politics issue, right? And this anti-corruption platform is fundamentally, this corruption discourse basically comes from the IMF and World Bank, right? Which they used in the 80s and 90s to basically dismantle whatever developmental states, whatever kind of little welfare state there was in the third world, in different parts of Africa, South Asia, and so on, by saying that, look, all of these elites are corrupt, these states are corrupt, so what do? We hand over everything to the private sector, right? And what is corruption? Corruption is about these bad apples, right? These individuals, which are basically, if these individuals are removed, these bad apples are removed, then, and you just have honest technocratic experts in charge, then everything will be fine, right? This is the kind of underlying basis behind this corruption discourse. And this kind of very simplistic, moralizing, almost individualizing discourse of corruption has been a great boon for right-wing movements all over the world. We know this from Trump. We know this from Modi in India. And of course, Imran Khan is not Modi. He's not fascist. A lot of liberals make him out to a fascist. It's absolutely wrong, right? He's a center-right figure. He has conservative views with religion, women, society, and so on and so forth. What is most his politics, as I said, he actually allies with the military to come into power. So again, you know, not a reform point there. And his economic policies in power, we can have a review of those. But fundamentally, in 2018, he comes into power, and 19, because he's coming into power on the back of a crisis, as I've been saying, a crisis which is long in the making. So in 2019, like every other government in Pakistan, he goes to the IMF. Right? Like every other previous government in Pakistan for the past 10 years before him. And what happens when he goes to the IMF? The usual, right? You do austerity, you cut welfare programs, whatever little welfare programs there are, you cut spending on education, you do, you know, you move, you set up a foot moves towards privatization and so on and so forth. Again, I want to again emphasize that Khan is not exceptional in this. A lot of the liberal intelligentsia, liberal left people, make Khan into some kind of unique monster. Like just like in America, they make in Trump into this kind of unique monster, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not the case. He's basically a product of the failure of liberal technocratic forms of neoliberal hegemony, mm-hmm. and which has all over the world is now being taken over by right-wing populist, and because they're populist, they're contradictory forms of hegemony, if you see what I mean, right? So if you look at his policies and power, this is what it is. It's capitulation to the IMF. It is because he's coming into power on the back of the military, on the back of these kind of big sugar mafias, real estate mafias, just like previous governments, he ends up appeasing all of these people, right? So for example, during COVID, the Imran Khan government announces a $2 billion relief package. Mm-hmm. Most of that relief package, some of that goes to poor people as well. Again, credit where credit is due. But most of that $2 billion relief package basically goes into the pockets of the construction mafia in Pakistan and the real estate mafia in Pakistan, which is really strong, right? Now, a lot of Khan supporters will tell you that they were welfare measures within Imran Khan's government. So they talk about things like he instituted a health card in different parts of Pakistan, where people can basically anyone can go take this health card, go to any hospital, private or public, and get their medicine or, you know, treatment done, and the government will pay for through that health card, if you see.
Oh, wow. Right? Okay.
Right. But the issue, let me tell you what the problem is. Similarly, he does this kind of cash transfer programs to poor people in Pakistan. Now, there are two things here. The cash transfer programs were being done by previous governments as well, but Khan expands this much greater, to a greater extent. The issue is this, that the cash transfer programs is happening in this wider context of increasing neoliberalization and privatization and austerity, right? So what is happening is, and this is what we call in development literature, this is what we call the social turn that IMF and World Bank took in the 1990s and 2000s, because they realized that actually all the structural adjustment and austerity is causing a lot of destruction in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. So let's still do marketization. Let's still do privatization. Let's still do liberalization. But let's do these little welfare handouts to poor people to just ameliorate this kind of wider destruction that we are doing. You see what I mean? So this is in the literature, this is what is called a social turn of the IFIs. And the welfare programs of the people who came into power before Khan and Khan's own, reforms in power, or sorry, this welfare program in power is part of this wider IFI social turn, where you do limited amounts of cash handouts while limited targeted amounts of help to, you know, the poorest of the poor, while the wider context is of liberalization and austerity, right? So let me give you an example of this. The health card I mentioned to you with Imran Khan, which Imran Khan instituted. Now, that sounds like a fantastic idea, right? That anyone can take a health card and go to any hospital and the state will pay whatever is the cost of their treatment. But that is exactly the American model, right? The problem was that because the state does not discriminate, the scheme does not discriminate between private and public, the incentive always was that people will go to private hospitals and private hospitals will charge exorbitant amounts and they will then put that to the state exchequer and that will basically bankrupt the state. So instead of basically improving the public and universal healthcare system, you have basically incentivized private healthcare providers. You see what I mean? This is almost the exact American model, right? So this is kind of what we call stealth privatization, which was happening in other in previous governments in other sectors, in education. In the previous government, it was happening in education through what we call public-private partnerships. In Imran Khan government, it started happening in health. And I can give you an example of what happened. So I was reading, there was a report very recently that over the last 4 years, since this health card has come in, the number of C-sections happening in Pakistani hospitals, in private hospitals in Pakistan, has increased by 40 times.
Wow.
Right. So why is this happening? This is happening because private hospitals are now government doctors in government hospital are saying, actually, if you come to me, come to my private practice. In private practice, then I will charge you instead of a normal procedure for birth. I will charge you for C-section, for example, a C-section. Okay. And then I will charge that money to the state, to the public exchequer. Right. So instead of improving the public healthcare, what you've incentivized is private kind of appropriation of public wealth, if you see what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of stealth kind of privatization which has been happening, again, not just Imran Khan government, but in previous governments as well. But what I'm seeing is that a lot of these kind of so-called welfare measures are in the short term, they sound really good, but in the wider context, they have destructive effects. And that is why I'm saying that, you know, we need to have a very grounded understanding of actually, okay, let's look at what the measures were in power and how they came into power, what the social coalitions were, and so on and so forth. Sorry for the long
story. No. Hey, that's why you're here. For the long lines. So it sounds like Imran Khan is just a typical neoliberal leader.
Yes and no, right? Okay. No in this, yes, in fact, exactly. So in terms of the policies that he has while in power, no, because of course, because he comes on the back of a crisis, he is also very popular among large sections of the population, right? In fact, one can also look at it from the other side, is that the ruling bloc in Pakistan, which was in crisis, which has been in crisis, terminal crisis for a long time, and especially from the late 2010s onwards, because of the decrease fundamentally of American aid and the decrease in Chinese investment. And we can talk about that later if you want. Because of this kind of wider decreasing kind of foreign aid, the Pakistani ruling bloc has been in crisis. So Imran Khan almost becomes this popular figure, which is absorbed by the ruling bloc and basically gives them a last popular legitimate face to perpetuate their own rule, right? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And in that sense, of course, so in that sense, it makes complete sense as to, I mean, in that sense, we can understand as to how Imran Khan came into power, by alliance with the military, right? And because once he falls out of power, because he is a popular figure, right? And because the wider crisis does not abate after Imran Khan's fall, because the wider crisis is much, much broader than one person or another. It's about the social class coalitions which are in power. And the people who come in are representatives of the ancient regime in Pakistan. His popularity, in fact, increases, right? So he is almost this last resort of the ruling bloc to give itself popular legitimacy. He himself in power, because of the wider conditions and social structures and coalitions through which he is in power, is not able to solve these issues because of his own inclinations, because of the program or lack of program that he had, right? Right. And then once the internal workings are such that he falls out with the powers that be and he falls into contradiction with them and he is ousted from power, but the wider conditions become worse and worse, right? Because this is a much more deep rooted crisis than just Imran Khan or the military and so on and so forth. He almost becomes this nucleus in which all these frustrations are finding their outlet. Right. So as a result, where initially he's and still his main support, core support base is in the middle class. Now he's actually a much more popular figure. His support now is much across much wider class basis, if you see what I mean. And this is then what happens in the current elections, which are even more manipulated than the last ones which brought Khan to power, right? Because as I said, Khan allied with the military and then manipulated elections in 2018 to bring him into power. But now, because Khan himself is a popular figure, to keep him out of power, you have to basically ramp up everything by 15 times. So the military manipulation, the sham part of the elections compared to 2018 have now basically taken on a completely qualitatively different level, if you see what I mean.
So usually aligning yourself with the military assures that you'll stay in power. And you're saying that there was one person that wanted, the military wanted to do some internal, moves that he said no to keep his alliances, it sounds like. Was it that big of a deal for the military, or this was a pretty big person trying to shift around?
Look, in Pakistan, everyone who comes into power, be it Imran Khan, before that, other people have come into power with some tacit understanding with of the military.
Okay.
Right? Either openly, like Imran Khan came in 2018, or implicitly before that. Right? And we can discuss how that is. But the issue is that the military is such a big player in Pakistan. It is so extractive. It is so onerous upon the polity and the social structure that even the most bourgeois of politicians, even the most elite of politicians, eventually fall in contradiction with the military. Right? That happened to Imran Khan's predecessor. That happened to their predecessor. And that happened to eventually to Imran Khan as well. So when he came into power, everyone knew. We were writing about this. All of us were in Pakistan. We were seeing what was happening. We knew that at some point, and Imran Khan's government at that point, they were the closest to the military among all the previous governments. But we knew that this was going to happen. They are going to fall out. Why? Because again, the military wants to encroach upon other domains, right? Like foreign policy, internal security, things like terrorism, things like the economy, and so on and so forth. So that always brings them into contradiction with other elite actors, right? But also, as I said previously, with the Punjab province and the economic discontent part, the wider crisis is such, the wider crisis in Pakistan's economy and society is such that, of course, military will at some point those discontent, that kind of discontent, that kind of, conflicts within wider society will translate into the military, into the military itself as well, right? Because the military doesn't stand in the air, it's part of society eventually, right? And that is actually what happened, right? So in Pakistan, the unfortunate part is, and we can talk about why that is, that politicians have relied on the military to either come into power or stay in power, but the military-civil partnership in Pakistan is what we would call a poison chalice. No one who drinks from that poison chalice will survive. And this is what happened to Khan's predecessors. This is what happened to Khan. The difference is that the wider crisis is such, and Khan's popularity is such, that he's basically come into contradiction with the military in much more direct and violent ways than his predecessors. And that is what we are seeing happening in Pakistan right now.
Well, the new Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, has been sworn in for a second time. Sharif will lead a coalition government. What does that mean for the Pakistani government and the Pakistani people? And do you see him as part of the bourgeoisie old guard?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, these guys are the who's who of the ancient regime in Pakistan, right? Nawaz, this guy, Shehbaz Sharif, he's the second time prime minister. He served as chief minister of the main Punjab province, I think, about three times now. His brother has been prime minister three times and ousted by the military three times as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these guys are entrenched political dynasties themselves nurtured by the military in the 80s. Right. And now they have been brought into power. This is the current government, as I said, because Imran Khan's party, even though Imran Khan is in jail on ridiculous cases, as you mentioned earlier, he's been targeted on ridiculous cases, which is what happens to politicians in Pakistan once they fall out with the military. But Imran Khan's party or candidates backed by his party were on course for winning elections, at least a plurality of the all close to a majority in parliament, if not the majority. And the military intervened, the intelligence agencies intervened and basically robbed them of a majority. They are still the biggest party in parliament. But the coalition government which has come into power, it is arguably, not arguably, but definitely the most unpopular government in Pakistan since the last military government, since the last direct military government, which was in 2007. Right? So this is the most unpopular government in Pakistan. It is basically a coalition of, you know, entrenched political dynasties, elites linked to the military, big landlords, big capitalists, a lot of the people who are actually allied with Imran Khan as well, right? And of course, with the military backing them to do quote-unquote economic reforms, which Pakistan does need, but the kind of reforms these guys are wanting to do are exactly what Pakistan doesn't need.
Right? Give me an example.
I mean, they basically want to integrate Pakistan into the neoliberal world system in a much better way. Right. So for to put it very succinctly, Pakistan has been integrated into the world system, the imperial world system, imperial world economy and unequal world economy in a very specific way historically. And that way, that specific medium of Pakistan insertion is that the Pakistani ruling bloc with the military at its center has basically been the local gendarmerie of American imperialism, right? What they have done is they have basically helped America wage its wars first in Afghanistan in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Through the Cold War against the Soviet Union, then directly against the Soviet Union in the 80s, and then the so-called War on Terror, or what we should call War of Terror in 2000 and 2010s, right? Because of that, they have basically, because then it's the militarized insertion into the world economy, the military has become the main player, right? But they are now, and because now America doesn't have any regional wars in the any wars in the region, right? America wants to, you know, poke Russia, provoke China, help Israel to, you know, do their colonialism in Gaza and so on and so forth. Pakistan's ruling bloc has basically lost its reason for existence, right? Which is the crisis here. So they are trying to basically orient themselves from a war-mediated insertion into the world economy towards a more investment-mediated insertion into the world economy, right? Which is the more neoliberal kind of normal neoliberal integration, right? Which is where, you know, Saudi Arabia comes and invests in Pakistan, America comes and invests in Pakistan, Unilever comes and sets up factories in Pakistan, and, you know, exploit cheap labor, do some exports, and so on and so forth. So this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to basically reorient Pakistan's political economy in normal neoliberal terms, backed by the IMF, but it's not going to work. And which is why the crisis will just roll on. This unpopular government will also not last very long, because as I said, it is caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. It can't do the reforms, the kind of reforms that Pakistan needs, right? And the reforms that it will do under diktat of the IMF and so on will entail more dispossession, more austerity, more appeasement of elite groups, which will create more discontent, which will then probably get expressed more and more through Imran Khan and through probably realignments within the military itself, and the government won't survive long. It won't survive more than 1.5-2 years maximum.
Do you think Khan has enough support at this point with people and with his own party that he could get out of prison and actually challenge Sharif?
That's a very good question. This is something you need to think about. I think he has enough support. I mean, he's obviously challenged whoever is in power, right? They've had to work really hard to keep him out of power. He will get released at some point. I'm depending on, you know, if they are able to form a deal with the military, the Khan's party or not. I think because right now Khan, as I said, historically has been allied to the military, and the social classes that he represents have been allied to the military as well. Khan's big issue right now is with the current military chief, right? Because the current military chief and him is basically they won't get along, right? And the current military chief is both very powerful and also very unpopular. So now the current military chief's term runs out next year. It finishes next year. But in Pakistan, again, the generals always want extensions. So, for example, Khan himself in power, when he was allied to the military, he gave extension to the army chief at that point, whom he actually fell out with later on, General Bajwa, right? So this military chief will also try to get an extension next year, but he is very unpopular. So it all depends. I think if we have a change in the military, then or the military leadership, then it becomes much more likely that Khan will come out. He will come out at some point because the cases against him and this kind of, you know, corruption charges. I mean, everyone does corruption in Pakistan. And some of the charges against him around, you know, his marriage issue and so on, that's just ridiculous. It's absurd. It's not even, you know, doesn't even deserve to be talked about. So he will come out. His challenge to the military will depend on what his relationship is, what kind of deal is made or not when he comes out. But my assessment is that, you know, the problem is, as I've been saying, that Pakistan's problems are so deep rooted. They require such a deep program of revolutionary transformation that even when Khan comes out, the classes and social groups which are organized within his party neither have the capacity nor the imagination to carry out the deep-rooted structural changes that Pakistan needs, right? Which is the real dangerous moment that we find ourselves in Pakistan in, right? Which is that we have on one side a very, very unpopular government and ancient regime backed by the military, which is completely unpopular, completely bereft of ideas. On the other side, we have a popular force in opposition, which has historically got a right-wing record, and which the people in organized within the party are people of the middle classes, upper middle classes, organized within the party. Remember, I'm using this word very carefully. People who are organized within the party are of the middle and upper classes, and other people who were previously linked to the military regime, right? So, for example, Khan's party general secretary right now is the grandson of Pakistan's first military dictator. So the issue is that through the people who are organized within Khan's party as well, which is a popular party, also neither have the social capacity nor the imagination to take Pakistan towards a different path. That is a recipe for disaster. That's a recipe basically for chaos, right? Yeah. The potential here is, Jason, is that because Khan has so much popular support among young people, among increasingly among working classes, subordinate classes. And these subordinate classes, young people, are basically now learning and discovering through facing the repression of the military as to who basically calls the shots in Pakistan and what are the entrenched power structures. So they are basically forming a critique of the ruling bloc and its militarization through their own experience. And that is where, you know, a lot of serious work needs to happen from the left, rather than dismissing Imran Khan as a lot of liberals want to do, like in the parts of the world that, oh, he's a fascist, he's an extreme right winger and so on. That's nonsense. Or, you know, just falling with the bandwagon as if he's some new Hugo Chavez, which he's not. The point is that a lot of people are discontent. A lot of people are finding some kind of hope in Imran Khan, and a lot of people are, through Imran Khan, forging a critique of the current ruling order. And that is where a serious political left needs to go and work. And, you know, a lot of people are working in that regard.
Well, where is the left in Pakistan? If you're talking about a country with a serious military stronghold that's that big of the economy,
yeah,
how does the left function? How strong are they in parliament?
Yeah. So they're not strong. We're not strong in parliament, but there are pockets in which left and left-leaning kind of movements are strong, right? Especially because Pakistan is a really, for example, Pakistan is a really unevenly developed country. Pakistan is not one nation. Pakistan is a confluence of multiple nations. That's just the way colonialism happened in our part of the world, right? There are all of these, you know, created countries, for better or for worse, where, you know, people from different linguistic backgrounds have been mishmashed together. And this is just the accident of history that we live with, right? And it's a highly, deeply uneven social formation because of colonial patterns of rule, of colonial patterns of uneven development, colonial patterns of state recruitment, bureaucratic recruitment, military recruitment, and colonial and neo-colonial imperial patterns of war making, right? So, for example, in Pakistan's peripheral areas, where the US has been involved with in making war on Afghanistan, those areas have seen a lot of destruction over the last 20 years, over the last 40, 50 years. Similarly, another peripheral area of Pakistan, which is the Balochistan area, is basically a colony of Pakistani military, right? They exploit resources, they go and disappear people, they kill people, they do military operations and so on and so forth. Again, military operations which kept happening amongst, between, during all the governments, previous governments, Shehbaz Sharif, People's Party and Imran Khan government, right? So again, the continuity point that I was talking to you about. Anyway, point is that there are pockets in Pakistan because where, you know, movements based on class, movements based on national ethnic oppression are quite strong. And those are the pockets which can be built upon. The issue is that in the central Pakistan, we have small pockets where we have activity, but, you know, it's very hard, right? Because as I said, it's a very militarized ruling bloc. It's a very militarized society. And it's really hard to do serious, you know, I mean, it's important and we do that, but it's very hard to do, you know, oppositional political work. But people, you know, a lot of left people are really brave. They do fantastic work and they do have strength. We do have strength in pockets, as I said, in, you know, say among young people, you know, in, as part of the feminist movement and so on and so forth. So a lot of this rebuilding of the left needs to happen because the left in Pakistan has had a long decline after the Cold War and because of the American-backed dictatorship in the 80s and so on and so forth. But there are a lot of people doing a lot of work. And as I said, we need to be thinking about, okay, how do we understand and how do we engage with the people in this moment, this Imran Khan moment, who are forging, are facing the sufferings at the hand of the ruling bloc and the militarized ruling bloc, who are forging a critique of the militarized ruling bloc through this suffering, but probably through the kind of right-wing proclivities of Khan's party and the organized groups within it, are getting incorrect answers to real problems, right? And that is where the left needs to be engaging, and they are engaging. It's not like that. We do a lot of work on the left in Pakistan. It's just that, again, you know, we need to have both our organizational basis we need to deepen, and also we need to bring together a program, a genuinely anti-imperialist program of national sovereignty, which really talks about the fundamental issues in Pakistan, which is about fundamentally also the economy, because fundamentally Pakistan's economy is bust. It's bust because it has historically been dependent on imperialism, but there are no coherent alternatives which have come out, which can form and actually, which can point up of on a pathway towards, you know, what we would call an anti-imperialist delinking of Pakistan. And that is what we need to be working towards.
I mean, when you're constantly taking out loans from the IMF, it is kind of hard to do that, right?
I mean, Pakistan has, you know, it has a distinguished record. It has the most IMF loans in the last, it has more IMF loans in the last 30 to 35 years than all the countries in the regions in the region combined. So
really?
If you combine the number of IMF loans taken by Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan has more than all of them. Jeez. Right? So, and that is fundamentally because, as I said, that is fundamentally because the Pakistani ruling bloc has had no economic project for at least the last 50 years, arguably for 70 years since independence or so-called independence. But at least for the last 50 years, it has had no economic project except for selling its services to imperialism and also selling its labor to the bigger countries in the Gulf, in the US, in the UK, which is why you find so many Pakistanis outside of Pakistan, right? Because they then send remittances that also shores up the economy. So basically, Pakistan has been, in neoliberalism, what this, the neoliberals tell us, they have to export things, right? Third world country have to export things.
Yeah.
So China exports the iPhone, and, you know, it does a lot of, you know, it's basically the factory of the world, right? It's the workshop of the world. And, you know, what Pakistan exports, unfortunately, has been exporting for the last 50 years, is its military services and its people. Now, that has basically now become unsustainable. That kind of imperial structure, that kind of insertion into the imperial world system has generated a certain kind of social structure within Pakistan itself. And it has also been informed itself by a certain kind of social structure, as I said, with the military active center and a very elite-centered political economy. So what needs to happen, as I said, is a coherent political economic program which attacks these entrenched structures of power with the military at its center, with big capital at its center, with a highly unequal distribution of land at its center, and attacking an elite which basically invests in unproductive sectors, right? It does not invest in things like industry and agriculture, which can theoretically generate sustainable employment, but it invests in militarization, in things like real estate and finance. So, for example, I'll give you a figure. There was a recent report which told us, UN report, that Pakistan state gives Pakistani elites $18 billion of subsidies each year. That is more than the amount that Pakistan paid in debt last year, in debt servicing last year. Pakistan paid about $15 billion in debt servicing.
Yeah.
And it gives subsidies to elites of $18 billion.
Jesus.
Right? The other thing, in Dubai, the real estate market, Pakistanis are the third biggest foreign investors.
In Dubai?
In Dubai's real estate market. Among the three biggest foreign investors in Dubai's real estate market, number one are the Brits, number two are Indians, another poor country with elite making, you know, heyday, with elite making great amounts of money, and Pakistan, number three. So this is the kind of elite that we have, right? A militarized elite, unproductive and dysfunctional elite. This, the discontent that has generated, is also what Imran Khan is a product of, that crisis Imran Khan is a product of. Imran Khan is basically the symbol of a situation. He's not the situation itself, right?
Yeah.
And it is a situation that we have to counter. It is a situation against which we need to build a narrative, a program, and a social coalition.
We talk a lot on this show about the failure of institutions in this country, right? It sounds like there's something extremely similar in Pakistan. Yeah. How does the proletariat, how do the average Pakistani feel about their state institutions? I mean, I saw video footage of people out there protesting, you know, demanding that that Khan be let out of prison. But really, how do people feel about these institutions? Let's just say, wave a magical wand that he gets out of prison tomorrow and got back into power. Would anything really change? According to you, not much would.
Yeah, I mean, it would totally depend on whom he allies with to come into power, right? Mm-hmm. If he allies with the same upper middle classes and elites and parts of the military, then it's no use, right? There's no hope. And the thing is that the record suggests that this is what is going to happen, right? But as I said, because the wider conditions are of such deep crisis, such deep discontent, there is always the potential that other forces, left forces, can intervene, or progressive forces can intervene, but also that, you know, people like Khan and so on might be pushed in other directions because of the force of discontent from below, if you see what I mean, right?
Yeah.
So, if he comes into power tomorrow, which, I mean, it won't happen tomorrow, but, you know, I said, politics is now around Khan for the next few years. It will all depend on what kind of social forces, class forces come into power with him, right? the historical record with regards to that, with regards to Imran Khan's previous stint in power and previous rise to power, is not very hopeful in that regard. But so, but as I keep saying, as leftists, we always have hope not in these big figures or strong men. We always have belief and hope in people and the masses, right? And there we have to hope and we have to work towards organizing subaltern groups, subordinate groups, working classes, proletariat, peasant, oppressed nations in Pakistan, oppressed genders, in a coherent program, an independent program of, you know, national sovereignty, of multinational kind of, you know, amelioration as Pakistan needs, multinational liberation, and as I said, economic sovereignty, which attacks these entrenched structures of power. As I said, because the discontent is such that it might be that this kind of starts translating into the programs of already of elite actors themselves. But in that regard, the record of Pakistan's both the reform candidate, so-called reform candidate like Imran Khan, and of course the ancient regime, which is now in power and has been in power, both of their historical records don't bode well in this regard. So which is why we are basically in for a long period of chaos in Pakistan.
How is the Pakistani left organizing around this situation currently? Is this a good organizing tool in the moment right now we're in?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, we have been, you know, as I said, in pockets where we have the base, we have been doing the organizing that might be in urban, in certain urban areas, in allyship, as I said, with movements against national oppression, against war in the frontier regions and so on and so forth. But again, there needs to be much, much more work. We need many more serious people who have, you know, who are committed, who have a deep, good understanding, a clear understanding of the situation, and are committed to independent organization of subordinate classes without allying them to one elite actor or the other, rather either in the name of some kind of, you know, false anti-imperialism or in the name of some kind of fight against pseudo-fascism, which there isn't in Pakistan. If fascism ever comes to Pakistan, it will come through the military, not through Imran Khan. But yeah, so the left, you know, we have our pockets of work. We have been trying, you know, we have a new generation of people who are, you know, who have been radicalized over the last, you know, 5-6 years as to what has been happening. And there will be more and more people who will be questioning the ruling bloc, who will be questioning the militarization, who will be questioning the coercive depravities and the elite-centeredness of politics in Pakistan. Because, as I said, these kind of elite politicians, this kind of extant ancient regime, reigning ancient regime, they are not able to absorb and incorporate discontent anymore. So there will be more and more opportunities for the left and, you know, people who are working seriously on the ground. But again, as always, we have to, you know, do more and better and deeper organizing.
In closing, what are your feelings about this situation currently?
Right.
Do you feel it's just kind of the same old song and dance? Or do you think this one's a little bit different this time?
No, this is much, much deeper. This is, as I said, this is the deepest crisis Pakistani ruling bloc has faced for the last 50 years. The last time Pakistan ruling bloc faced a crisis like this was in the late 60s, early 70s, which saw the rise of a left nationalist, left populist government, which actually suppressed the left. And that's why it eventually fell to military dictatorship later on. But this is the kind of crisis that we are in. This is also why Imran Khan's support is so deep, right? Because of this deep crisis. The return of Sharif to office, as I said, is a continuation of the old regime, but it won't last long. They will do a new program of dispossession and privatization, and which will not work in Pakistan because they'll try to integrate Pakistan into neoliberalism in a different way, but it will not work. Because neoliberalism itself is in crisis the world over.
Yeah.
So that space for export-oriented growth, which China took advantage of, is East Asian governments, East Asian states took advantage of in the 80s, 90s, 2000s is now over because global capitalism is in crisis. So, as I said, we are in for a long period of chaos, which is right now being expressed through Imran Khan, but it has the potential to exceed. And then, you know, as I said, right now it's chaos and then it's gloves off, because if there is no progressive force in Pakistan to really bring together all this discontent along multiple national lines in Pakistan, along multiple fault lines of class and nation and gender in Pakistan, if there is no force which can bring these together, then we will move. We are already in a quasi-martial law situation for the last 6 years.
I was seeing that. That seems frightening. A lot of people have been arrested.
Yeah. It started, as I said, it started in 2017-18 with the rise of Imran Khan to power. It continued in Khan's stint in power, and now it has taken a qualitatively new jump by keeping Khan out of power, right? So that's a contradictory situation that we are in. And if things reach a certain impasse, you know, that quasi-martial law might become an actual martial law, which will be a real, real disaster for all of us.
And where can people find your work, Aziz?
I've written about the Imran Khan phenomenon both academically in academic journals, but more popularly, I've written for Jacobin around this. I've done podcasts as well on the internet in Urdu, English, both. I did a long podcast with Jacobin last year. Another article of mine, I wrote a pre-election article for Jacobin, pre-Pakistan elections article, and what I've been saying today in much more detailed, sustained manner. I've written a long piece giving a long view of this crisis for Jacobin, which will hopefully be coming out in the next few days. So yeah, I do write for different national Pakistani newspapers, but also international outlets, and you know, try to appear on comrades' podcasts when they ask me to.
Well, look, this comrade here in the West appreciates you taking the time to talk to me. We're off air. We're talking about bringing Aziz on to the Red Zone show, sports show, talk a little cricket.
Oh my!
So,
absolutely,
I'm holding you to that, brother.
Yeah, yeah. Summertime is cricket time. Right now it's term time.
Well, wherever you guys are watching or listening to the show, there definitely will be links in the description to Aziz's writing, the Intercept League. But sadly, you said the academic stuff we can't share, right? That's like you got to pay for it. It's all behind.
No. I mean, a lot of my academic stuff I put on my own academia page, and it's all open. I've also done academic, I mean, more theoretical, quote unquote, interviews about the theorists I work with, whom I really like, you know, which are Karl Marx, Antonio Gramsci, and Frantz Fanon. Those are the three people I really work with. These are the three kind of theoretical inspirations that I have. So that can also be checked out. A lot of that is on YouTube and, you know, other mediums.
Well, there'll be links to all of that in the description of this show. Aziz, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And we...